Hello, this is Todd Durakant with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, July 7th, 2026, coming to you from my home studio. We start on the front page under Community. Chalk art draws kids together. Decatur YMCA campus decorated with colorful creations. This article's by Donette Beckett, Decatur. A sidewalk isn't the only canvas for a few kids and a box of chalk. Clothing, legs, hands, and faces were free for the creative types during the Decatur Family YMCA Chalk the Walk. It turns out when you give littles any kind of art utensil, they'll make a mess, said Schuyler Krause, YMCA Director of Development, which is beautiful. The youths attending the Decatur Family YMCA summer programs and daycare located at 220 West McKinley Avenue invited the community to join them during a recent Chalk the Walk event. But visitors are welcome to add their own artistic creations anytime. According to Amaria Davis, camp counselor lead Chalk the Walk gives the children another opportunity to use their imagination. Just let them free draw, she said. Chalk is often available during any YMCA youth free time, which also includes games, outdoor free time, and other activities. They have a choice, Davis said. However, adults also can draw an encouraging saying or positive image. It's open to anybody, Davis said. They can just come up here and do it all day. Even the bumblebees in the 2-year-old daycare class were able to make their own colorful creations during a recent Chalk the Walk day. The dusty artwork is important to the toddlers, their teachers said. It lets them develop creatively, said teacher Jody Bethard. It lets them explore different textures, different colors. They get their energy out, too. The recent Chalk the Walk event gave the bumblebees an opportunity to show the older summer camp kids how it's done. The daycare classes are often found outside with chalk creating new images on the concrete surrounding their playgrounds and on the sidewalks winding through the YMCA campus. Sometimes they are drawing way down there, teacher Farah Plato said, pointing to the far side of the playground area. Some really cute photos here. Large color photo. Decatur Family YMCA Decatur classes take part in a Chalk the Walk day. And there's three children squatted on the sidewalk, drawing with various colors. Several more behind them standing, exchanging colors, and even more walking. Looks like walking away with their parents. Maybe they're done for the day. Donette Beckett Photos Herald and Review. And 2-year-old Sophia Montero adds to her chalk creation at the Decatur Family YMCA. And she's wearing blue overalls, a red shirt, and checkerboard white shoes with white socks. Has a bow in her hair, and her hair is pulled up. And she's, you can't really see her face, but she's bending down and looks very determined with a clenched right fist and using a large pink crayon in her left hand, which has contacted the sidewalk surface. And she's already colored in some orange and pink. U.S. Supreme Court justices split on shadow docket. Critics say SCOTUS emergency orders lack transparency and accountability. Articles by Andrew Chun, Reuters, Washington. When the U.S. Supreme Court issued its ruling defending the Federal Reserve from political interference, it not only prevented President Donald Trump from firing one of the central bank's governors, it also highlighted growing unease among the justices about the use of their ever-expanding emergency docket. 3 of the 4 conservative justices who dissented in Monday's ruling, involving the Fed's Lisa Cook, also criticized the 5 justices who were in the majority for making such a consequential decision using the court's procedure designed for emergencies and short-circuiting lower courts in the process. That prompted Chief Justice John Roberts to defend the landmark action using this pathway in the Cook case as a matter of prudence, on which people can disagree. Roberts authored the 5-4 ruling, joined by fellow conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh and the court's 3 liberal justices. Critics for years have raised concerns about the court's increasing willingness to decide major cases using the emergency docket, also called the shadow docket or interim docket, saying it lacks transparency and accountability to the public and gives short shrift to complex and high-stakes legal disputes. This docket lets the justices render decisions before lower courts have decided the legal merits of a case, generally bypassing the Supreme Court's regular procedures that involve extensive briefing, oral arguments, months of deliberation, and lengthy written rulings. Emergency orders are typically made rapidly and often provide no explanation or rationale. Now another concern is emerging. As more emergency decisions usher in vast changes to the law, and even after the court's own precedents, the justices appear divided over just how powerful this process is becoming and how to wield it appropriately. The justices completed their latest 9-month term on Tuesday and entered a summer recess. Their next term begins in October. What I find really telling is that Roberts felt he had to respond to it. He didn't have to. The opinion could have just decided the case, said Bradley University law professor Tara Lee Davis, an expert on the emergency docket, referring to the complaint by the dissenting justices. He felt the pressure of the complaint enough to put a principle on paper for the first time, Davis added. And the principle he lands on, that it's a matter of prudence, is honestly pretty honest about the fact that there is no rule, there is no formula. Formerly used only rarely, the court in recent years has transformed the emergency docket into a powerful force in American life, employing it to especially dramatic effect since Trump returned to office in January 2025. The court, with its 6-3 conservative majority, backed Trump in numerous emergency decisions that let him implement contentious policies impeded by lower courts while legal challenges continued to play out. Its emergency decisions have let Trump fire federal employees, take control of independent agencies, ban transgender people from the military, proceed with aggressive immigration raids, and deport migrants to countries where they have no ties, among other actions. The conservative justices wielded this power in multiple ways, largely siding with Trump, a Reuters analysis has shown. Among the emergency actions during the latest term that court observers argue revised existing law, the justices allowed states to redraw the boundaries of U.S. House of Representatives districts in the hopes of benefiting Republicans in elections and weighed in on the rights of the parents of transgender children. Using the emergency docket, the court also boosted Trump's power to fire independent federal regulators, allowing him last September to remove Democratic Federal Trade Commission member Rebecca Slaughter. It similarly let Trump fire other agency officials during its previous term. Dissenting in several of those decisions, liberal Justice Elena Kagan said a 1935 precedent of the court that insulated federal regulators from such at-will firings by a president should have barred Trump's actions. Kagan asserted that the emergency docket should not be used to overrule precedent or revise existing law. On Monday, the court overruled that precedent, a decision that expands presidential powers in a 6-3 ruling formally affirming the legality of Trump's move to fire Slaughter. It issued its ruling on the Fed's Cook on the same day. The court denied Trump's emergency request to block decisions by lower courts preventing him from removing Cook based on unproven mortgage fraud allegations that she denies. But the court made clear that its decision did not rule out the possibility of Trump prevailing in his efforts to remove Cook in the future after the allegations are vetted. No other president since the Fed's founding in 1913 has tried to fire a Fed official. Trump's attempt threatened to undermine the Fed's cherished independence. Justice Samuel Alito, joined by fellow conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch, wrote in dissent that the court should not have issued such a comprehensive ruling on Cook, given that the case was at an early stage and that novel legal issues were involved. Alito noted that the dispute reached the Supreme Court on the emergency docket just days after the litigation began last year. Those problems counseled in favor of a light touch by this court, Alito wrote. Echoing this criticism, conservative Justice Amy Coney Barrett wrote in dissent, "While a modest approach would have been appropriate, the court chooses to go big. Its opinion sets precedent on a series of important issues with implications that extend well beyond this case." Roberts responded to the criticism, writing, "How much to say on our interim docket is not reducible to any mechanical formula. It is ultimately a matter of prudence upon which reasonable minds can and often do disagree." Liberal Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson wrote that unlike in other consequential emergency docket cases, the court spent more time considering this one and took the rare step of hearing oral arguments. The complaints by the conservative dissenters mirrored those made by two of the court's liberal justices in another emergency docket decision called Mirabelli v. Bonta in March. In that case, the court blocked a series of California laws that can limit the sharing of information with parents about the gender identity of transgender public school students without the child's permission, siding with Christian parents who challenged these protections. The ruling extended protections under the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment right to due process, recognizing the rights of parents to receive this information. These policies likely violate parents' rights to direct the upbringing and education of their children, the ruling stated. In dissent, Kagan, joined by fellow liberal justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, criticized the terse, tonally dismissive ruling designed to conclusively resolve the dispute. Today's decision shows not for the first time how our emergency docket can malfunction, Kagan wrote. Education. New laws tackle AI cyberbullying in classrooms, Naomi Taxay, Medill, Illinois News Bureau. Earlier this year, administrators at Lake Zurich High School confronted a growing challenge facing schools nationwide. Students using artificial intelligence to create sexually explicit images of their classmates. After reporting the matter to police, this district launched a series of student and family education efforts focused on online safety and responsible technology use. The incident illustrates the kinds of situations Illinois lawmakers may have had in mind when they passed a bill last year requiring schools to address AI-generated content in their bullying prevention policies. Beginning July 1st, the state's definition of cyberbullying was expanded to include AI-generated digital replicas, forcing districts across Illinois to update policies and procedures. Also by July 1st, the Illinois State Board of Education was required to develop statewide guidance on artificial intelligence in schools. The guidance is expected to address AI-generated false representations of individuals to help districts update their policies ahead of the 2026-27 school year. ISBE Press Secretary Lindsay Record said that while the agency is still developing guidance, it remains the case that local policies, procedures, and responses to specific incidents are determined at the district and school level. In Lake Zurich, for the coming school year, officials expect to build on the guidance provided following the earlier incident. The district anticipates continued integration of explicit teaching opportunities for all students regarding safe, responsible technology usage in alignment with the core district values. Jean Malik, Executive Director of Communications for Lake Zurich Community Unity School District 95, told the Medill, Illinois News Bureau in an email. Additionally, the district anticipates continued information and resource sharing with families on how to best support safe technology usage. Even though schools already have policies to address bullying, the new law provides important clarification by naming unauthorized AI-generated digital replicas as a newer form of harm, said Scott Rowe, superintendent of Township High School District 214. The message is clear, Rowe said. AI does not have to remove responsibility. The law, he said, will give districts clearer language for policies to student expectations and family conversations. The school-focused legislation doesn't change Illinois' criminal statutes governing AI-generated sexual imagery. Under the state law, AI-generated sexual images that appear to depict minors may be prosecuted under child pornography and related obscenity statutes, depending on the circumstances. Creating, possessing, or distributing such images can result in felony charges. The issue is not isolated. A 2024 survey by the Center for Democracy and Technology found that 40% of K-12 public school students were aware of a deep fake involving someone in their school, including 15% who knew of a sexually explicit deepfake depicting a member of their school community. The survey also found that many schools had not proactively addressed the issue, with more than 60% of teachers reporting that their schools had not shared policies or procedures related to AI-generated sexual imagery. Laura Tierney, founder of the Social Institute, a company that provides schools with digital literacy resources, said Illinois is taking a step in the right direction by acknowledging that educators have a role to play alongside law enforcement in addressing harmful AI-generated content. Legislation alone won't solve the spread of this. With legislation has to come education on the topic, and Illinois schools now have a legal obligation to address AI-generated cyberbullying, Tierney said. And so now I think the question is whether they have the curriculum and the tools to back this policy up. Tierney said most students are well aware that deepfakes are hurtful, but might not fully understand how to support their friends if they see images circulating online. I think this is an opportunity to coach towards the positives rather than solely scare students with the negatives, Tierney said. It's old school to focus on how harmful it is, like here's all the legal implications. This reality is that it's still going to happen, so how can we help students make positive choices? Rowe said the biggest challenges for schools was responding to incidents involving AI-generated content are speed, realism, and reach. Images can spread quickly, and students may not know whether or not they are fake. AI-generated content may be artificial, but the harm it causes can be very real, Rowe said. Rowe added that students do not have to create the original content to contribute to the harm. Sharing or forwarding it can extend the damage and may result in school consequences, and in some cases, legal consequences, he said. Anything related to AI, it's a bit of a game of whack-a-mole just because the technology is evolving very quickly, said Deborah Jacobson, general counsel of the Illinois Association of School Boards. Kids are often way ahead on technology and what they're doing with it, so it can contribute to the challenge. I don't think it's anything necessarily new, but I think the trend has just been accelerating. Naomi Taxay is an undergraduate student in journalism with Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, Media, Integrated Marketing, Communications, and a fellow in its Medill, Illinois News Bureau, working in partnership with Capital News Illinois. Capital News Illinois is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service that distributes state government coverage to hundreds of news outlets statewide, It is funded primarily by the Illinois Press Foundation and the Robert R. McCormick Foundation. On some state news, on A2, Democrat committee to host summer soiree, Decatur, the Macon County Democratic Central Committee is hosting a summer soiree from 5:30 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, July 8th at the Beach House in Decatur. A host of state, federal, and local office holders and candidates, as well as party officials, have been invited to attend. The cost is $50 per person. The Beach House is located at 2301 East Lakeshore Drive, Decatur. Call Brian Smith at 217-381-8589 or email macon county dem chair1@gmail.com. And that's the number one, not O-N-E, for more information or to reserve a spot. 4 years for $18,000 watch robbery, Tony Reed, Decatur. The Decatur man, whose theft of an $18,000 watch sparked a police siege of his home, is now serving time in prison. Jerrion A. Jarrett, 19, was sentenced to 4 years incarceration after he pleaded guilty in Macon County Circuit Court to a charge of aggravated robbery. A further count of armed robbery was dismissed by presiding Judge Thomas Griffith as part of a plea deal negotiated by Chief Public Defender Michelle Sanders. A sworn affidavit filed by the Decatur Police Department said the crime dates to the afternoon of March 13th when the 28-year-old robbery victim was accosted outside a convenience store in the 300 block of West Grand Avenue. The victim told police three men surrounded him and two of them pulled out handguns the victim recognized had been modified to fire as submachine guns. He said the robbers demanded his expensive Swiss wristwatch, which he handed over. Officer Harry Vickers, who signed the affidavit, said the victim had seen the robbers emerge from a house in the 1200 block of North Edward Street, and he saw them flee back to that address after the crime. Vickers said police surrounded the building and ordered everyone inside to come out. Jarrett eventually emerged, but there was no sign of the other suspects who remain wanted. The victim was later able to identify Jarrett as one of the men who robbed him. Vickers said police did not just take the victim's word that he owned the watch. He was able to provide a digital photograph of authenticity with a serial number for the watch, the officer said. Jarrett was sentenced when he appeared in court June 29th and had been in custody since his arrest. His guilty plea had been an open one, which meant the length of the sentence was left up to the judge to decide. Griffith ordered that the defendant would get day-for-day credit while serving his punishment. Teen who shot into house headed to prison, Tony Reed, Decatur. James E. Kapler, Jr. is now housed at the Graham Correctional Center, where he is likely to be spending most of the next 5 years. The 19-year-old Decatur defendant was sentenced after pumping bullets into a home in the 800 block of West Center Street, while a 43-year-old father was inside and five children aged from 10 to 1 years old were either inside or playing on the front porch. Kapler took a plea deal in which he admitted committing an attempted aggravated battery through the discharge of a firearm. Three other charges accusing him of the aggravated discharge of a gun at an occupied building, aggravated unlawful possession of a weapon, and unlawful possession of a handgun were dismissed as part of the deal. Presiding Judge Thomas Griffith actually sentenced Kapler to 10 years but ordered it served with day-for-day credit, effectively halving the actual prison time. The judge also gave him another 3-month credit for time spent in custody since his arrest February 18th. A sworn affidavit filed by the Decatur Police Department in support of Kapler's arrest warrant said the shooting dates to the evening of September 29th while the father in the home was standing in the kitchen. The father is quoted as telling police, "A bullet suddenly smashed into the glass door of his oven, causing a graze wound to his left shin." Police would later find four other bullet holes in the residence and recover a bullet from the living room. The affidavit said that the father had looked outside and saw a suspect identified as Kapler in the process of running away, accompanied by two other teenagers. A police dog was brought in by arriving patrol officers, and the dog picked up a scent trail that led straight to a nearby apartment in the 1400 block of North Poole Street. Officer Lucas Bray, who signed the affidavit, said a woman who lived there with her baby told police she allowed Kapler to stay off and on. A subsequent search of the residence turned up two handguns with extended magazines, parts of a handgun hidden in a trash can, and a disassembled .40 caliber handgun in the bottom of the kitchen stove, and a .22 caliber handgun stuffed inside a cereal box. The woman told officers there should not be any firearms in her residence, Bray said. Kapler was recognized as the gunman by witnesses, and he was implicated further by gunshot residue testing carried out by the State Police Crime Lab. Kapler was sentenced May 29th, and the judge agreed to recommend him for substance abuse treatment while he is incarcerated. And finishing this second, or first half hour rather, with some positive news from page A5. Anniversary Stocks 70th Mount Zion. Bill and Janet Stocks of Mount Zion will celebrate their 70th wedding anniversary with a family dinner. Bill Stocks and Janet Harris were married July 6, 1956 at Mount Zion Presbyterian Church. They are the parents of Sherry David Gatton of Parma, Idaho, Jeff Stocks of Dalton City, and Jerry Natalie Stocks of Decatur. They have 6 grandchildren and 12 great-grandchildren. Bill, who recently celebrated his 90th birthday, is a retired farmer. Cards can be sent to 340 Secretariat Place, Mount Zion, Illinois, 62549. Okay, well, we're within the last minute here of the first half hour, so we will end very shortly, take a short break, and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, July 7th, 2026.